Welcome to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. Join your hosts, Anita Russell, Mavis Bauman, and Gail Hunter, as we create a brave space for conversations about racism, personal transformation, and accountability. Conversation provides a means to dive deeply into your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs and examine what emerges in your words, actions, and behaviors. The show is a journey towards anti-racism by cultivating change within yourself first and then out into the world. Learn to engage in racial dialogue using four tools: courage, conversation, relationship, and accountability. Discover how truth, reconciliation, and healing can emerge from honest and deliberate conversations. Manifest social change right now on Inflection Point Podcast. Well, thank you for joining us for the newest episode of Inflection Point Podcast. I am your host, Anita Russell, and here's a quick hello from co-hosts Mavis and Gail.
Hello, hello. I'm Mavis Bauman. Thanks for listening in tonight.
Hi, I'm Gail Hunter, and thank you all for coming tonight.
Excellent, excellent. So our topic for this evening is imagination and critical race theory. And the question of the hour is, what is the connection between the backlash over Disney's Little Mermaid, Halle Bailey, and critical race theory? And we are very blessed to have a prolific writer, advocate, and teacher with us today who is going to lead us into that conversation. So who is Allison Gaines and why should you care? So Allison Gaines is a writer, editor, and unapologetic Black scholar pursuing her PhD in psychology. She's from New Orleans, Louisiana, and writes about race, women, history, politics, and culture. Allison is the co-founder of Writers and Editors of Colors, or WEOC, and the editor-in-chief of the Culture magazine. You can find her bylines on Oprah Daily, Zora, Momentum, and Level. So Allison, what I'd like you to do is just start off by telling you this a little bit about your journey of getting from where you were to where you are as this prolific writer.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm really happy to be here. So as you said, I'm from New Orleans, and writing is a big part of like our city's culture, how we document our history and even things that don't make it into official history books, whether it's families writing stories in the back of Bibles and that sort of thing. So when I grew up, my mother was an environmental lawyer, and she used to give me these notebooks that had recycled paper in there. So I would write little poems and little stories that I would not share with anyone. And when I turned 14, I started attending a school called NOCA, which is New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. And I went there to specialize in writing as a junior high school and high school student. That's when I started actually taking myself serious as a writer and started learning about young writers around the world, and won second place in the William Faulkner's writing competition for a fictional short story. So, and I also got experience as an editor there, where we edited a publication called The Umbra. We took all of our work and we tried to find the very best and learn to criticize one another. And out of that would come this beautiful document that we could share. For a while, I got caught up with being a young adult as far as going to school and having to work full time. So I took like about 2 years off of writing. And then my mom's house actually burned down to the ground. So all the things that I've written throughout my life were gone. And it was at that point I started to think about publishing and about how, you know, maybe writing wasn't enough, that I actually wanted to share my ideas. And after George Floyd's death in 2020, I decided to publish online. And kind of that that's how I became someone that writes regularly about social justice issues.
Excellent, excellent. Because around 2020 or so, the latter part of 2020, I think is when you and I first got connected. Because we had one phone call where I was telling you about the podcast and that one day I wanted you to be a guest on the show. And so here you are. So can you tell us a little bit more about why you chose the particular topic? So as I read in your bio, you write about race, you write about women, you write about history, politics, and culture. That's a lot. So why did you choose those particular genres when you decided that you were going to write full time?
I feel like I wrote and then I analyzed the genres that I like to write about. So, you know, I've always been interested in social justice issues. When I was little, I used to help campaign in the projects and try to register people to vote. And I joined the Southern Christian Leadership community and that committee. That's like from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., where they teach young people how to be activists. My mom used to be head of the Department of Sanitation. We used to encourage people to recycle and stuff. So I feel like activism is just in my blood. First campaign I helped with was John Kerry. And I was in seventh grade at the time. And so like, as I grew older, you know, I learned to use my voice in like really constructive ways, because me and my friends, we did, you know, protest Lee Circle and all those sorts of things. And we would go around the city with our bullhorns and scream until our voices are hoarse and nothing would change. So I started to think that if we write, if we organize, if we really think about the structures of power, we can make a difference. And the reason why I write about those topics is because to me, they're all interrelated. So, you know, politics is the science of power. If you're going to care about racial injustice, then you're going to have to also care about who's in power, who's calling the shots, that sort of thing. And history is part of that too, because without history, you will not understand modern day politics. You will not understand the racial schism in this country and women's rights, because women, I'm a woman, I'm a Black woman. And, you know, Black women experience misogyny, which is a combination of racism and sexism. So it's like, I have to acknowledge that disparity as well, and just that underrepresented voice in academia as well as literature.
Excellent. Mavis Gale, what do you think of our guests so far?
I am very impressed.
Very impressed. Very impressed. Indeed, yeah. Indeed. I'm just amazed how she holds so much in her head and is able to act on all of those passions. Yeah. You inspire me. You inspire me.
Good. Thank you.
And the journey that you've taken and coming to this place has just been incredible. You've really listened to the very deep place within you and let that guide you.
Yeah. Allison, just something we can even talk about later, but is there one key driving force in you, like a role model or a particular issue that pushes you forward and says, I just have to do this?
To me, it's criminal justice reform. And my hero is Ida B. Wells, because she wrote Uncomfortable Truths. And she talked about shining a light on injustice. Yeah. So I feel that that's important, and that we have to continue to shine a light on injustices so that we can actually find some type of remedy or solutions for the injustice we see. When she was writing about lynchings in the South, that made a lot of people feel uncomfortable. But what she was doing was she was developing a case against the practice of lynching. And as you know, recently Congress passed the anti-lynching bill in honor of Emmett Till. So it's like her activism, it made a big difference in the country. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in my life, because when I read her work, I'm inspired. And at one point they tried to kill her, and they tried to burn down the press that she was working at, but that didn't stop her. So like, I think that's my driving force, is they're not doing to you what they were doing to her. So you have no excuse but to just persist.
Wow. Boy, that is very true. Very strong.
And that's really a good point that you bring up, this whole idea of this uncomfortable truth. Because there are so many different avenues where that realization is becoming more and more and more prevalent, that talking about these things is uncomfortable, but at the same time, being oppressed by racism is uncomfortable as well. And so if we don't take that courage, as in our introduction, we talk about this thing of having these conversations and stepping to this space of courage. If we don't do that, then we're just stuck. And I don't know about y'all, but I'm tired of being stuck in this place where racism is just still very prevalent. And it feels like in a lot of ways, things are starting to fall apart. Some things are starting to go backwards. And we just cannot stay in this place. And part of that is stepping into that which makes us discomforting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're right, because we all have to look within ourselves and see where that truth lies within us. And that's painful. It's not just uncomfortable. It can be at times very painful. But if we don't do that, then that truth will not be able to be seen and heard by everyone. And it's time that it is. It's beyond time that it is. Mm-hmm. And so, Allison, you are certainly helping to contribute to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're definitely in that place where truth has to outweigh discomfort.
That's right.
In order for us to really be able to move forward. So what we're going to do for the remainder is what Mavis Gale and I did was we went and selected several of your articles, actually, but we had to narrow them down because we couldn't talk about each and every one of them. But one of the articles that you had written about was this whole entire controversy over Ariel now being a Black mermaid. Halle Bailey is the young performer that is in that role. And it's just all of this hoopla, if you will, over the fact that she's in this role. But one of the things that I find really interesting is because I found a video where it was talking about where she, it was actually her, and she was talking about how she, when she was little, they used to play Little Mermaid. You know how we were when we were little girls, we played house and all of that. And they used to play Little Mermaid and, oh yeah, I want to do this and I want to do that. And so for her, that is such a poignant thing for her now to actually be in that role. But then it's in the midst of all of this supposed controversy. And the title of your article is Racism Cripples Imagination. That's why you're boycotting a mermaid. And I'm going to read just a quick quote, and then I want you to kind of respond to that. When Disney announced Halle Bailey would play the leading role in The Little Mermaid in 2019, the white backlash was quick to follow. Now that millions of people have seen the movie trailer, that fire has been reignited. And it says, if some white people can't fathom the idea of a Black mermaid swimming and singing and making friends and pursuing love, so when the hashtag not my Ariel started trending, it became clear that it's not anger, sadness, or disappointment that some white fans feel in learning Ariel would be a Black princess. It's racism. Mm-hmm. So if you could speak to, you know, maybe what was your mindset as you were writing this article?
Well, when I first, you know, heard about that there was going to be a Black Little Mermaid, I was excited because I watched Little Mermaid growing up. Me and my sisters, we would just sit around the house. That was one of the Disney films that we had on tape. Where we could watch it anytime we want, and we loved it. We loved the songs. We were rooting for Ariel, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I heard that it was going to be a Black woman, you know, that made me really happy. And you know, it kind of took me back to my childhood, like, wow, how would my life be if I saw some of that growing up? And I thought, it was a positive change. And I knew that there would be some backlash because I kind of heard it would. I saw when it first was announced, but I didn't expect it to be like this. And that was on the heels of fans complaining about Black people in different episodes of kind of like Lord of the Rings type of spinoffs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it started to become apparent to me that even though these people were completely imaginary and it's a fictional story, a lot of people took issue with her being Black. And, I try to be reasonable. I mean, I'm sure that we all do. But what I mean by that is I don't always assume it's racism. I tried to really think, you know, what is it? Is it anger? You know, is it really just, but like, are they angry? You know, are they sad? And I'm like, why would you be sad? Are you disappointed? I'm like, yeah, maybe you are all those things, but you're all those things because of the racism, and like to take it a step further to boycott the movie. Because it's one thing to not see it, you know, that's your choice to not see it, but to boycott it and encourage other people to stay away from it, that was concerning to me. And that's what made me want to write about it, that I felt like it's so disappointing that to me racism cripples imagination. Because if you can't even imagine a Black mermaid, then I think that that's pretty sad, a sad state of affairs, you know?
Exactly. And one of the things that you said, that the irony shouldn't be lost on us, that claiming a Black mermaid is unrealistic, ignores the fact that a mermaid is a mythological creature. So I'm in the same boat with you when I think about that. Like, mermaids aren't even real, right? And you're upset over a Black woman playing a role in this made up character kind of thing. Like, what does that really say about who you are as a human being? Right. And I read or saw a video with one gentleman, and I purposely didn't even want to remember his name, because what he was saying was just like so off the wall, just trying to prove scientifically that mermaids are white people.
Because they don't need protection from the sun or something in the bottom of the ocean.
Whatever. I mean, it's a mythological creature.
Nonsensical argument.
Right.
Right. I mean, but it shows how like nonsensical people... racism is.
Yeah. Good.
Exactly.
Point.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is exactly right. That was a really powerful statement that you just made. So can you expand on that a little bit?
I feel like
racism is nonsensical.
Yeah, meaning if you critically think about the world, disliking someone because of the color of their skin is fundamentally illogical. And so I guess that's why I found it, you know, kind of comical, because you have to laugh at some of these things, that they would be so frustrated at an imaginary creature. But it makes sense when you understand that racism is inherently illogical. So of course it would follow through that the racism is not going to have logic to it, because there's nothing logical about disliking people just because of the color of their skin.
Well, and racism began with illogical, right? It was all based right. on lies and a need to cover up the truth of what was really going on. Right. So of course, that would just fall into place, right?
Yeah. Right. I think it's not a coincidence that when you look up in the scientific literature, when you look up anti-scientific, anti-intellectualism, that you also find racism. This is why, you know, like I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but why critical race theory comes into play here, because it is that it's the idea that if you critically think about history and reality and people and our relationship to one another, you won't be racist. And I think there's a lot of people that are scared for that critical thinking to occur or to be inspired.
Could I ask a quick question here? What do you think, Allison, people are most afraid of if they were to change? Just that feeling inside, what would a person have to lose? I know that a lot of racism is connected to power and so on, but wouldn't it be a relief not to fight about the color of a mermaid? What is the change that is so frightening?
I think that it's frightening because I think it has a little bit to do with guilt. Because the only reason you would be, let's say we have a baton and each of us talks when we have the baton. The only reason I would be scared of giving you the baton is if I just thought that that would overshadow my voice. And so it is that, like, that unwillingness to share the world that we live in and share the culture, because American culture does involve Black people. And so if it's going to be an American spin on a fairy tale, then to me it makes perfect sense that Black people be a part of it. Like when Brandy played in Cinderella and Whitney Houston, I love that rendition. I watched a regular Cinderella, but I like that one too. And I think some people are afraid because they don't really understand. They think that if Black people somehow get into power, right, and they have all these diverse voices, they think that they will be mistreated. And that's what I mean by the guilt. Because if you weren't guilty, you would be like, okay, it doesn't matter who's holding the baton, because I have faith it's going to be fun. It's going to be fine. It's like that resistance. Mm-hmm. But that's been around since slavery, because that was their excuse. Like, well, we can't let them free because they would kill us, right? But we saw that that actually wasn't true. Right. And it's the same thing with the civil rights. Oh, we can't let them sit at the same counter as us because they would hurt us. Like, it's almost like when you have your foot on someone's neck and you're scared to let it up because you're scared they're going to hurt you. When in not realizing that, you know, the Black Power movement, you know, as we've discussed in the past, is about seeking equity. It's about seeking equal opportunities and diversity and inclusion. It is not about supremacy. And so I think that the people that are afraid, it's because they're, unfortunately, they're white supremacists. And so they believe that we are in turn Black supremacists or Asian supremacists or Latino supremacists. Mm-hmm. That's what they, it's like almost like that's what they mm-hmm. tell themselves to justify their stance.
Well, it's all projection, right? It's exactly. Putting on somebody else what really belongs to themselves. And that's really based in fear and insecurity. Yeah.
And I think about, I mean, there's so many different angles in which we could kind of think about all of this and have these conversations. But when you think about mindset, so that's one of the areas that I really like to focus on is mindset. So if you think, if you're familiar with Carol Dweck, and she talked about this whole thing of fixed mindset, growth mindset, and then somebody also added a third, which is a benefit mindset, right? And when you think about racism, particularly when you're thinking about it within the context of white people and how they do or don't view, but they act regardless of what their view is, they still act in a particular way. Is this idea that if, like, this whole thing around the browning of America, like all of a sudden, and it's been getting browner and browner. I mean, it started mm-hmm. off brown when you really think about it with the Native Americans. It started off brown, so to speak. Right. Mm-hmm. And this idea that they've been sort of indoctrinated into this idea that if you win something, it means I have to lose. Right. So if you make a gain, it means I take a loss. But that's not what equity is. Equity mm-hmm. is basically like you gain some based on where you are. And then I gain some based on where I am, but it's not conflicting. It doesn't have to right. be conflicting. So people create this idea in their minds that it's a conflict because somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. The alternative way of looking at that is through that growth mindset lens where we can grow and they can grow. And we can grow mm-hmm. together as a nation when everybody is given that platform for growth.
Right. And I amen. Think when, oh my bad.
I was just gonna say, amen. Okay, go ahead. That's exactly what we need. You know, the growth mindset. That's all. That's not right. scary.
Right. It doesn't have to be.
And I always say that they have a scarcity mindset, people mm-hmm. that are racist. And that's the same kind of right. concept that you're talking about, where they believe there's only a little bit, and that if Black people get a win, they will lose. And that makes them oppose policies and changes like putting a Black mermaid on display. They fear that doing that means, well, will we ever see white characters again? And the answer is yes, you will. And, you know, there will always be white characters mm-hmm. and, you know, you will be seen, but understand that Black girls grew up watching white princesses, and we still mm-hmm. bought things with their blankets on it, bought their toys, mm-hmm. asked our parents to take us to Disneyland to see them. We supported it in every way, shape, right. and form possible. And all we're asking for is inclusion, not right. erasure, because we wouldn't right. want erasure, you know?
Right. Exactly.
Yes, yes. So when you think about the boycotts, they're doing exactly the opposite of what you just described, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Like, we all had Barbie dolls, and I can remember the time when there was only white Barbie dolls, right? Mm-hmm. And then eventually that began to change. And of course it makes sense that that would want to change, right? And so one of the things that that I came upon also was the NBC News article that was talking about parents who were posting TikTok videos of mm-hmm. their Black daughters getting excited mm-hmm. when they saw this black face as the Little Mermaid. And one black mermaid is joyous from the perspective that little black girls, little girl said, "Mommy, a little girl, she's brown just like me. The mermaid is brown just like me." Mm. But the thing that really resonated for me was the joy.
Right.
The joy that they felt in seeing that.
Exactly.
Didn't she turn a backward somersault? Rest herself by just rolling around on the floor. And that just made my heart sing to see that joy. And I had no idea that there was the absence of that before.
Mm-hmm.
I would have known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But just think about it. Like, for example, we all grew up with, maybe not Allison, but the three of us all grew up watching The Wizard of Oz,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. And it was always white people.
Right. Yep.
It was always white people mm-hmm. until The Wiz.
Mm-hmm.
So when The Wiz it was just like, oh my gosh,
and my life into it, right?
And it was just like, whoa, this is really awesome. Yeah. But that wasn't to the detriment of The Wizard of Oz.
It didn't take away anything.
It didn't take away anything.
It added something, right?
Good point.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So when my children grow up, they watch The Wizard of Oz and they watch The Wiz.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it didn't have to be this either or, it can be both.
Exactly. Yes. That's
it can be both.
It's an and, it's not an either or.
Exactly. And that's the part I think that the angry people, that they don't understand. Like they don't, it's not that they don't understand, because it's they don't believe. They don't believe that the true goal is equity.
Well, because
that's the only way I can make sense of it, because it's either that or it's just hatred. You know, it's either they don't believe we're genuine in what we say, that we really want equity and equality and diversity and inclusion, or it's that, you know, they're hateful. It really isn't too much wiggle room there. Because
I think
a black mermaid, and it's not like she's an inexperienced actor. I mean, she could sing, she could dance. Exactly. She's made for this. She's worked for Disney. I mean, like, what more do they want? You know?
Yeah.
Right.
And her face is like a princess.
Oh, I know.
I just saw the most gorgeous picture of her today, and I thought I would have picked her immediately. There's something princessy about her,
mm-hmm.
her look, her spirit.
Mm-hmm. And her locks. I love, like,
oh my gosh,
with the hair going like that, and her locks are going like that. It's just beautiful. It really is beautiful. So then also when you think about, I was thinking about Hamilton, when they did the show Hamilton on Broadway, I read an article where it was one of the white actors, and the article was about what did it feel like for him to be the only one, or one of very few. So he talked about the fact that his being in that performance actually helped him to learn more about racism. And he said, "I didn't realize the extent to which people that I know would have these stories, because they, you know, they would hang out together and have dinner and all of that together, and they would share these stories. And that was part of educating him on what it feels like to be in a racist society." So it looks like it's time for us to take a break at this point. So we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll continue the conversation.
Are limitations holding you back from living a powerful and authentic life? Are you able to see yourself and others through a lens of empathy and compassion? Tune into Awaken Your Truth with me, Ritika Rose, to discover how to free your mind, heal your life, and embody your power. Second and fourth Thursdays at 9 a.m. Pacific on Transformation Talk Radio, YouTube, and across all podcast stations. I'm on a mission to inspire a shift in you, so together we can collectively heal the world. To learn more about me, visit RitikaRose.com.
Life is good when you are in the right place, at the right time, doing the right things. I would love to coach you and get you there. My goal is to help you live your dreams, commit to your success, and be your best self. Become unshakable. Schedule a free introductory coaching session with me and join the Unshakable Movement. Connect with me at Coach Lisa at lisabelts.com. That's COACHLYSA at LYSABELTZ.com.
Tune into the Life Strategy Show with your life strategy mentor, Lolita Smith, and say yes to bringing prosperity and success to your future right here and right now. Life is a picture of your mind, and Lolita is here to help you imagine it. Say goodbye to the strings of the past that have been holding you back for far too long. Rise up with Lolita and say yes to the solutions, prosperity, and unlimited possibility. Visit LifeStrategyMentor.com. That's LifeStrategyMentor.com.
Are you living life in full expression? Join me, Beth Wolf, on Life in Full Expression each Monday at noon Pacific Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. To learn how to explore, elevate, expand, and live your best life, discover the seven dimensions of life blueprint of expression. Get ready to fully express, develop your limitless capacity, and experience amazement to become an igniter and inspire. Visit BethWolf.com to discover the dynamic coaching of life in full expression.
You've been listening, but are you watching? Tune in to your favorite shows on the Transformation Talk Radio Facebook page. We stream live video podcasts every day, and we love to hear from you. Leave comments and questions for the host to address live, on the air, and get to know the faces behind the voices you love. Just go to Facebook and search for Transformation Talk Radio.
Yeah, yippee-skippy to that, baby.
Well, welcome back. You are listening to Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio. I'm your host, Anita Russell, and I have Mavis and Gail here and a very special guest, Allison Gaines, who is a writer. So we've been kind of picking her brains about some different topics and everything. So we were just finishing up a conversation where we were talking about all of the controversy and the anger and everything over the Little Black Mermaid that that Disney kind of rolled out the trailer and everything. So I'd like to sort of piggyback off of that conversation, if you don't mind, and into answering this question: how does the Little Mermaid backlash connect to critical race theory?
Thank you. I think that it connects because obviously people, first of all, the people that are angry, they do not understand critical race theory. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are against critical thinking because that's why they're angry about A Black Mermaid to begin with. Critical race theory asks us to look at the historical truth of this nation about the prejudice and the anti-Black racism that has been inherent in our country since its inception. And it asks us to look at the world through that lens, to critically analyze the world through race, just as critical gender theory does the same thing, looks at the world through the lens of gender. So I think that when we look at the fact that there has been historically a limit of Black representation on screen, it makes sense to have a Black mermaid. But the people that are against critical race theory would also be against addressing that because they have not fundamentally accepted the first premise that there is a historical discrimination and racism still exists.
Absolutely. So I'm going to read a quick quote that you had that I picked up out of your article. And the title of the article is, "White People's Fear of Critical Race Theory is Based in Ignorance." And the quote is, "Our nation is in the process of exchanging colorblind ideology with anti-racism. White people will have to take a good hard look in the mirror and into their family albums. Some are afraid of the skeletons they will find, and others are leery of the theory that will make them take a look in the first place." Mm-hmm. So that's a powerful statement. So if you could kind of dig into that a little bit for us.
Well, when I was writing that, I was thinking about a story that I read about Mitch McConnell and how his ancestors owned slaves. And I was thinking about how he is in opposition to the policy H.R. 40, which would examine the role of slavery and racial discrimination in the United States from 1619 into the present. And so I find it ironic that he hasn't analyzed his own family tree to understand or acknowledge what has been done, and in fact stands in opposition to any analysis of that. So the example I would provide is the fact that he opposes H.R. 40. H.R. 40 would not just write a check to Black people. It is a study. So he's against the study because he doesn't want the issue to be critically analyzed. That's a perfect example of what critical race theory is and what the people in opposition to it are trying to do. So when I say it's race based in ignorance, I make a distinction between, to me, ignorance is not about being what you would call stupid. Mm-hmm. Ignorance is about ignoring the truth. It means you are very much capable of understanding and you choose not to. And so I feel like the opposition to critical race theory is rooted in opposition. And if you look at that story that I published, look at the comments, look at what the people that are saying that are in opposition, none of them are familiar with the people who wrote the theories. No, none of them are familiar with the tenets of critical race theory. None of them are familiar with the application or lack thereof in academia and in our public school system. So that's what I had no choice but to consider their opposition ignorance, because I have not had one person who opposed it be able to clearly say what it is and what their issue is that was an accurate representation of what it really was.
Yeah, I can't imagine the parent not wanting my children to learn what is true, to learn the real truth of whatever that subject and topic would be. And especially about our own history in this country. And that is such a huge piece of our history at the base and core of it, that to ignore that, to not want to share that information accurately is just, it's very difficult for me to wrap my mind around that. Mm-hmm. And because we can't grow if we are not willing to step into that truth, whatever that truth is about.
Do you think that each generation has to knowingly reject the teaching of African history? Because I don't recall it ever even being mentioned in my house in school. And I'm wondering if it just kind of got buried and the absence of it got handed down. I don't know. I don't know how curriculums are set in
small pockets.
Pardon?
It was intentional.
It was intentional.
There's nothing unintentional about that. Oh. And the interesting thing about what you just said was, even though you may not have had that when you were growing up, you grew up in the community that you grew up in, we all, I'm not even going to be monolithic about it. I'm just going to say, I know in my household, we were aware because we read books about Black folks and, you know, just different things like that. Or like my grandson, he's only two. I'm already buying him books that I know are going to build him up as a person, right? And my daughters grew up reading all of these like historical fiction books that from, you know, that were based on Black characters and things like that. And so while it may have been missing over here and I may not have been getting it to the extent that I would like in school, I was still getting it at home or getting it when I went to the community center or I went to, you know, a Kwanzaa celebration or something like that. Like it was still infused there.
But we had to go out our way.
Absolutely.
To me, in my school, because I graduated high school 2006, so that kind of gives you a little perspective of when, you know, this was happening. But we read one paragraph about slavery. And it didn't even refer to Black people as people. It was just slaves working. And see, when I was growing up, it wasn't so much that white parents were like, we're not going to learn about Black things, because they didn't have to, because it wasn't in the curriculum.
Right.
So I went through school. I read one Black author. It was a book, When Things Fall Apart. And it was an African author. It wasn't an African-American author. And even when I went to the writing school, we had to read like 20 or 30 books a summer, and they were not Black. Any of the Black writers, I had to actually go out and search them. So the white backlash we see today is actually in response to it, the Black writers being implemented. And yeah. because they were implemented, now it's this like, let's take them back out. See, so before you might not have seen the opposition to it because it wasn't necessary because Black people were already not in the curriculum. And I think that's the problem we have now is like, you know, we should have been able to learn about slavery. We can learn about World War I, World War II, the American Revolution, the Civil War. If we can learn about people dying, atomic bombs dropping and all that, Holocaust, then we can yeah. certainly learn about the chattel slavery system. Right. That's my opinion anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's mainly right. because it's so ingrained. It's so ingrained in like so many different things. And I think to a certain extent, there's also, I look at it also from the perspective of the responsibility on parents, right? So when my kids were little, I remember one particular instance with Olivia where she goes to school. She went to a little small community school and she goes to school and they're doing, you know, that typical Thanksgiving with the pilgrims and, you know, that whole activity. So she comes home. And she's, you know, she's sitting down, she's describing to me, okay, what did you all talk about in school today? So she's telling me, okay, we talked about this, that, and the other, and we talk about the savage. And I had to stop her right there. What do you mean savage? Oh yeah, you know, the Indians, they were savages and blah. Right. No. But it just so happened that I had a Native American encyclopedia in my home. And so I walked over, got the book off the shelf, opened up the book, and I said, now tell me what you see in these pictures. And mm-hmm. she was like, well, they don't look like savages. Exactly. Sorry. And so what I said to her was, when you go to school tomorrow, you tell your teacher that your mother said you are not allowed to refer to any human being as a savage.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
We were taught in school that the wrong people were the heroes. Because mm-hmm. if you look at the mm-hmm. real history of Columbus, I mean, either genocide is wrong or it's not. You know, either it's wrong or it's not. And it's like, so you can't say Hitler is bad, but Columbus, let's have a holiday.
Right.
Let's throw a holiday. And it's like, that's, so that's, when we talk about critical race theory, that's the part that kind of, that they get mad at when people like us, you know, I've grown up in my, you know, my brother, we always make jokes like, you know, it's colonizer day, you know, when it's Columbus Day or one of those days that only really speaks to white Americans. Mm-hmm. And it's like it's the white people today did not create that, but they have a role that if they want things to change, if they want to say, you know what, the idea of a Columbus Day after he killed all those people, it makes me sick to my stomach and I don't want it. I don't want it in my schools. I don't want it in my community. I want mm-hmm. people to know the truth about him. I think. Yeah. That's really what critical race theory, that's the point of it. That's what you're supposed to do. It started as a legal theory, but like any critical theory, it's rooted in psychology. Anytime you're talking about critically analyzing the social structures in our society, and I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, just like I'm uncomfortable with Hitler, I'm uncomfortable with Columbus doing that to those people, and I'm uncomfortable with a holiday that honors him every year.
I think they're finally changed that. However, how many years has it taken, right, to recognize right. that? Yeah, it's the same thing with racism. I mean, it's, you know, it's how many more years is it going to take for us all to be willing to look in that mirror, yeah, you know, well, and to really yeah. see what is true, and to want our children to know what was true.
Right.
The shame that is maybe hidden is going to continue being hidden and experienced until it's all brought out, until we can look and see what really was going on, and. Yeah, from that right. perspective, begin to see where the truth really has always been.
And part of what needs to happen as we're, you know, speaking very openly about these types of subjects is that breaking the cycle of socialization into white supremacy is also a major piece yeah. of this. I saw, we had talked about this earlier, the video with Russell Ellis, who he did a TED talk where he was talking about going from being a white nationalist, white supremacist mm-hmm. to being anti-racist. And he described some of his experiences, but the way he described it is, I was socialized into white supremacy,
right?
And so in addition to the critical thinking and you know, really understanding critical race theory, we also have to understand how that socialization happens. Because one of the tenets of critical race theory is just recognizing that race is a social construct. Exactly. And so that socialization piece is definitely there. So what do you all think about, what are your comments on that?
Race is always a social construct, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is not an innate fact or truth. It was created and created to justify behaviors, exactly, choices that were being made by white people. And to buy into that, to not be able to sit in that truth and see that reality, is still participating in it, in racism. And we've come too far to continue this process. I mean, it's time for everyone to just be willing to look inside and really say, okay, this may be true. Yeah, this is what I grew up learning and knowing, and I can change. It doesn't have, I don't have to be afraid of it.
Yeah. You know, Anita, I think my comment earlier about the curriculum in my schools and that, it was part of our socialization, mm-hmm, for generations. There were no books about Africa in my house.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Africa existed. So I'm just thinking, mm-hmm, right now, how has that changed?
Mm-hmm.
How has that set me up to be in the world?
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly I've benefited from the you know, white supremacist system. But anyway, I think that, you know, my parents didn't have intention to keep it from me. It's just shocking to, yeah, go ahead, Anita.
I want to ask you a question. I want to ask you a question. So if you were a parent, you, Mavis,
mm-hmm,
you were a parent, and you were, mm-hmm, raising children up today, what would, mm-hmm, your household look like? Knowing what you know, knowing, having me as a friend all of these years, and, you know, being involved in this anti-racism work and doing Inflection podcasts and a long talk, what would your home look like for your children today if you had children?
It would look like the world, you know. It would be every, you know, as much as I could, everybody would be represented. And certainly, you know, I, as much as I've read about Africa, my house does have a lot of books about Africa now, you know. So certainly I would have been a, you know, a big proponent of it. But I guess, you know, when you talk about the ignorance, I wonder if they ignored, or if it never came across their dinner table. I just don't know.
But that is ignoring.
It's ignoring. Exactly. That's ignoring.
You're allowing it to come across.
I mean, if you walk out of your house on any given day and you're walking around in the world and you see that there are actually people in this world that look like you, and you make no effort whatsoever to try to understand or to, you know, just to get a sense of who they are, or, you know, why is your music like this, or why is this, or how does that happen? If you show no curiosity, if you show no critical awareness,
right,
that these are human beings that are walking around in human skin, going to jobs, getting in cars, getting in their houses, going to the supermarket, picking up their kids from daycare, reading books to their kids before they go to bed, all of that stuff is what we do.
Right.
And so if you're making that choice that you're not going to critically raise your own awareness of that, that's, to me, that's where Allison is coming from when she uses the word ignorance. You're choosing not to be in a place of ignorance.
Not to know.
And
exactly.
And also, like, even if you live in like an all white community, right, and you don't see Black people, you still hear what's going on. Like, say for example, I was young, right, but y'all remember the Watts riots after Rodney King. And so when that happened and the entire country is talking about race, it's like, you do hear it, you know what's going on. It's like, it's just uncomfortable, so you push it away, or you say, you know what, I don't know any Black people,
it's so somewhere maybe else.
Maybe this doesn't relate to me, but it's like, we all share this community. And, you know, I you know, like I believe in democracy, and I believe that racists are afraid of democracy. They're afraid of equal people having equal decision in the type of world we live in and the type of decisions that we're going to make together. And so part of that is like basically getting interested. Like, for example, I don't have any like LGBTQ people that are like in my phone on speed dial that I'm very close with. But I feel like that's not an excuse for me to where if I hear something, somebody said something out of line, if it's time for me to vote for the Equality Act, when it's time for me to use my power, I'm going to use my power right. And something else you said about with, you know, racism. See, here's the thing, you know, all white people are not racist. All white people benefit from a system of white supremacy, so they have white privilege. But it is what you do with that white privilege that defines you. So it's nothing to feel weird about. It just is the way it is. Like, if you look it up, black babies are more likely to die in the care of white doctors, newborns. So it's like, even if you're in your house and you never hear about a black person, understand that that's what's going on in your local hospital, that that's what's going on in our society, that the police that smile in your face and say, how are you doing, ma'am, that they're not treating other people the same. And I think that it's about, you know, and it's hard because in America, we're taught to think of ourselves in an individualistic way. Whereas in Africa, the culture is collectivist. Yeah, so I think that's kind of the social gap too between black and white people is it's like, we think of it like, well, if you're hurt, I'm hurt too. And so we kind of like the white people that are good at being activists and allies, they take it upon themselves when they see a black person being hurt or an injustice, they feel it in their heart too. Just as we want men to feel it in their hearts when women in general across the board are suffering from things that only impact us, like that sort of thing. Empathy.
Right, the ability to access empathy and compassion.
Yeah, true confessions. I did grow up on soul music, so we had a podcast about this, and I had no idea what the words meant. Fight the power. I just didn't. I had no frame of reference for it. Yeah, but I love the music.
That's interesting.
Oh, ignorant.
So we're like super running out of time, although we're not ready to end yet. But I wanted to shift a little bit and just talk about some final thoughts from through the lens of anti-racism activation. So I read an article in Very Well Mind that describes anti-racism this way. Anti-racism is a process of actively identifying and opposing racism. The goal of anti-racism is to challenge racism and actively change the policies, behaviors, and beliefs that perpetuate racist ideas and actions. Anti-racism is rooted in action. So what's your response to that?
Yes.
Yeah, that's your response.
Absolutely. I want to hear Allison's response.
Yeah. I love it because it ends the complacency. It ends the colorblind, the myth of colorblind, you know, ness. And it takes us to a place where we feel good about being alive, where we feel that our lives make a difference because we have the power to make the change. And so instead of just feeling bad, like, oh my God, this country's so racist, woe is me, we're more like, no, I'm going to do something about it, or at least as much as I can. And when you do as much as you can, then you can feel good. Because we're making our contribution while we're here on Earth. And that's why I love it. I think that anti-racism is important and the work must continue. And it must continue, and people have to have those uncomfortable conversations. And I believe they won't be uncomfortable once you have it. It's kind of like just telling your family some big news, like, mommy, I'm moving to California or something like that. And you might be scared, but once you get through it, you're like, okay, it's all love. Because that's one thing about anti-racism. When anti-racist white people work with black people, they are welcome. So while it may be scary to do it, once you do it, you're going to be welcomed by a community that wants you to learn and wants to work with you.
Absolutely. So we're down to our last 3 minutes. And what I'd like, Allison, if you wanted to call out any calls to action, website or whatever that you would like to direct people to, now would be the time to do that.
Okay. Well, with the November election coming up, first of all, I would like everyone to go to vote.gov, make sure that you're registered, understand what the voting rules are in your districts, and study the issues, study the candidates, and just really critically think about your decision. That will be my call to action. If you want to follow me, you can check me out. I'm Allison Gaines. You can find me on Twitter, or you can look at my publication, which is Cultured. So you go to readcultured.com, or my organization, Writers and Editors of Color, by writersandeditorsofcolor.com. And I'm just really thankful for the time you gave me today. Thank you.
Oh, you're so incredibly welcome.
We are so grateful. Yes.
This has been dynamic, because this is actually the second time today that we had a chance to talk with you.
I know. I am very grateful.
It's like super ongoing kind of conversation. So we're almost completely out. I just see the 1 minute mark popped up there. So I wanted to leave you all with this quote. And this quote actually comes from Russell Ellis, the gentleman that I mentioned earlier, who is the white supremacist who kind of socialized himself out of that life and into anti-racist. He says, so this is the title of his TED Talk, White Supremacy, Same Dog, Same Tricks. It's time to change the training, right? So here's the quote. I come from a white little town in North Carolina. I learned white supremacy. White racism was so casual where I'm from that it's culture. And that culture breeds the next generation of white supremacists. And so just like we're trying to breed a new generation, if you will, of anti-racists, that parallel track is that there are individuals out there that are grooming the next generation of white supremacists. And I think we see that all around us in our politics and all of that. So, yeah. So for the audience, I want to thank you. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And we will see you next time right here on Inflection Point Podcast on TransformationTalkRadio.com. We are here every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific time and 6 p.m. Eastern time. And we will see you the next time.
Thank you for listening to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. The journey towards anti-racism and social change doesn't stop here. Truth, reconciliation, and healing come from ongoing, open, honest, and deliberate conversations. Continue to dive in and deconstruct your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs as we band together to manifest social change. Tune in to Inflection Point Podcast every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, here on TransformationTalkRadio.com for more conversations about how we can cultivate change from the inside out.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.